Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. We started our One Planet series after Donald Trump won the Electoral College in 2016. At that time, we knew that most in the media would not give the climate crisis the attention it deserves. Well, here we are in 2024, and our series will be more important than ever, given what's about to happen under a second Trump administration. The world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann says the United States poses a major threat to the planet. 2024 is on track to be the hottest year in recorded history, according to the Copernicus Climate Change Service. It's also the first year above 1.5 degrees Celsius. Extreme weather, much of it made more intense by climate change, is wreaking havoc around the globe. But, of course, Donald Trump dismisses it as a hoax. According to the New York Times, people working on Trump's transition team have already prepared a slate of executive orders and presidential proclamations on climate and energy. They include withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement, eliminating every office and every agency working to end the pollution that disproportionately affects poor communities, and shrinking the size of national monuments in the West to allow more drilling and mining on public lands. Against that backdrop, diplomats and heads of state from nearly 200 countries are gathering for UN climate talks in the small petrostate of Baku, Azerbaijan. Joining us to talk about what a second Trump administration will mean for the climate crisis, the planet, and UN climate talks, and also where this leaves the climate movement, are two guests. Adam Fetterman is an award-winning investigative journalist and a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. He writes about environmental policy, public lands, and corporations and police spying on environmental activists. Hi, Adam. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it is great to have you back. And again, Adam, thanks for all the great work that you've done on climate over the years. We're also joined by Antonia Juhas, an award-winning investigative journalist focusing on climate and energy policies. Antonia Juhas serves on the National Press Club's COSIC Environmental Justice Grant Committee and developed the course Fossil Fuels and the Climate Crisis at Tulane University in New Orleans. Antonia is the author of many books, including her most recent, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Antonia was on with us last week talking about a recent piece she wrote in Rolling Stone. And I just keep thinking about this because I have never heard of this Justice 40 initiative, which Antonia wrote about. It's a Biden-Harris administration plan that stipulated within days of taking office, at least 40% of federal climate and environmental funds that total about $613 billion must target disadvantaged environmental justice communities. People on the ground say they've never seen anything like this. And now that Trump is in office, it'll most likely go away. Hi, Antonia. Thank you so much for all the great work that you do, and thanks for coming back.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on again. It's great to be back with you.
Well, I just want to also say that in addition to Trump going back to the White House, the Republicans have taken back the Senate. We're still waiting on the House. We don't know what's going to happen, but people say the Republicans could also take back the House. So the White House, the Senate, and the House. Antonia, you know what's at stake. First off, how are you doing? And what is your reaction to this major, major shift in power?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question, Rose. I'm doing okay. There's a lot of work to be done, and it's really time to double down and start doing it. I'm really happy to be an investigative journalist right now and having the tools to be able to dig once again into the policies of the Trump administration, though I honestly didn't really expect that this is where we were going to be today. And I keep reflecting back on when you and I, in 2016, when I was your guest at the Roxy Theater hosting the live election returns, and just being so shocked by Trump's win that night. And I felt again the same. And I think part of the reason why is that the polls once again were wrong. I mean, we were told that we weren't going to know the results in Pennsylvania until Wednesday or Thursday, because that was due to the expectation that the election was going to be so close that every single vote was going to need to be counted, and that would take days. Instead, we knew the same night as the election, and the polls once again did not reflect the views of the public. And I think that, I honestly think the main reason for that is because the public continues to not tell pollsters their true feelings. And that's either because they're not telling them to themselves, they're not being truthful with themselves for why they're voting and who they're voting for, and or they're misrepresenting their views to pollsters, or pollsters are asking the wrong questions, which is always possible. But I think a lot has been fixed since the large polling errors of 2016. And I think it really comes down to people not being honest with how they were going to vote. And what we've seen in the polls is that basically what we saw is a pretty large shift of men voting for Trump. And the youth vote was down, and the youth vote and the youths that did vote, there was a big shift in young white men from the Democrats, from Biden to Trump. And I think that that trend of basically white men in particular shifting from Biden to Trump is a big part of the story here. There was more attention to climate in 2024 than 2020. It was a larger, more significant issue to more of the voting population. And in polls, people said, you know, overall resoundingly that they trusted Kamala Harris more on climate than Trump. And climate voters voted significantly more for Harris than for Trump. But, you know, Trump put forward a very clear agenda that, you know, I think is fair to describe as a, you know, probably one of the most racist and misogynist campaigns that we've seen in some time. And if you dig into the policy proposals of in Project 2025 and that Trump has put forward, and that those who are likely to be part of his administration have put forward, they're very clear that they want to attack what they call the woke, quote, equity agenda of the Biden administration, and shift away from policies that support environmental justice, justice communities, communities of color, communities that have been disproportionately burdened by the impacts of fossil fuels and the climate crisis, to clearly move away from addressing the climate crisis overall, and to double down on fossil fuels, which also has a disproportionate harm on communities of color, as does the climate crisis. So I think, you know, sort of overall, we see this sort of clearer picture emerging of what we can expect in terms of policy. And then also, I think one of the biggest lessons for those who support the Trump agenda and the Trump administration, is they learned a lot of lessons in between the last 4 years, and they were slow to get started and sort of slow to understand the inner workings of the federal government and how to implement the policies that they wanted to see implemented, and remove the policies that they wanted to see removed, and the people they wanted to see removed from the federal government. And that now they are much clearer on what they want to accomplish, how they want to accomplish it, and the tools they need to put it forward. If they already have the Senate, as you've said, if Republicans also have control of the House, and if they do, it will be slim, that's clear. If they get control of the House, it will be a slim majority. But it will be, you know, if it is a majority, that will make moving policy significantly easier. And obviously with conservatives in control of the Supreme Court, it will make maintaining those policies easier as well. So the stakes are very, very high, and there's a lot to discuss. You know, a lot for us to discuss in this hour together. So thank you again for having me.
That's Antonia Juhas, an award-winning investigative journalist who does great work really reporting on frontline communities. We're also joined by Adam Fetterman, a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. Adam, you do a number of really great deep dives. We've had you on many times talking about your pieces, whether it's about the Arctic or your recent piece with Jimmy Tobias about Trump. If Trump wins, U.S. parks and wildlife face a new age of mining. So same question to you, just given how much you care about these issues, how are you doing and what is your reaction to this major shift in power?
Well, I would echo what Antonia said in terms of just being determined and sort of ready to get to work. I think in a lot of ways, we know more about what this administration is going to do and what its intentions are in terms of dealing with public lands. And we know now that the people who they're going to put in positions of power to sort of execute that agenda, which is not at all reassuring. But I do think that, you know, you have to essentially move quickly and start reporting and figuring out how we're going to cover this administration. And I think one thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently is, you know, in terms of investigative reporting, what was effective the first time around and sort of how I'm going to modify the way that I approach Trump 2.0, because I do think it's going to be different. And I think the kinds of stories that we're going to need to write and the way that we sort of present them is going to have to be tailored to sort of this new moment.
Oh, that's interesting. So what have you come up with so far?
Well, I'm still sort of in the thinking phase, I guess. But one thing that I'm wary of is chasing leaks and scoops, which I think became very easy to do, you know, during the first Trump presidency, in part because we didn't quite know where things were moving. They were unprepared, and you had a lot of personnel turnover. I mean, just at the Department of the Interior, for example, as many of your listeners will remember, you know, Trump appointed Ryan Zinke to head up the department, and his tenure was quickly sort of engulfed in scandal after scandal. And in some ways, I think it was a bit of a distraction. I mean, the media feasted on each and every one, and they were often somewhat frivolous. And you had David Bernhardt behind the scenes, who was deputy secretary and ultimately took over, who has years of experience at the department and in the private sector, ultimately took over and I think quickly put in place the kind of agenda that the Trump administration is now sort of putting together, you know, before they even take office. So I think we have to be more strategic, and we have to, you know, keep our eye on the ball, I guess.
For this discussion, can we talk about the big picture, the globe, and then drill down to the United States and then to state and local policies? Because now that Trump is in office, we're going to really have to rely on state-level politicians and local politicians to take action. So let's first talk about what's at stake for the globe. Given just the power of the United States and whether it decides to lead or not lead makes a major difference for other countries. And again, it's just important to note that according to the Environmental and Energy Study Institute, the United States has a significantly high per capita greenhouse gas emission rate. On average, each American emits a large amount of greenhouse gases compared to people in other countries. And then, of course, when you drill down in the United States, it's the ultra wealthy who emit the most. So that's really important. But Antonia, can you talk about this? Now that the world knows that someone like Donald Trump is about to take power again, and knows that what he's going to do around climate is most likely going to be worse than the first time. Talk about what that means for the climate crisis across just globally.
Yeah, I mean, you know, today we're having this discussion as COP29, the next United Nations Conference of Parties meeting gets underway in Azerbaijan. So the last Conference of Parties meeting, the last COP28, was in Dubai. This year it's in Azerbaijan. As we understand, the reason for that really has to do with Vladimir Putin saying that this is the country that he wanted the COP to be hosted in. It's a major petrostate, deeply dependent on its oil and gas infrastructure, deeply autocratic, deeply restrictive, and hosting the United Nations Climate Conference of Parties meeting. The significance of the role of the United States is there are multiple levels where it's significant in the international fora. And one is, even though the climate conference was held in Dubai last year, it was the first climate conference where there was a commitment to transitioning off of fossil fuels. And it wasn't as strong as we would have liked. It didn't have language that said phase out, and it didn't make it time specific, and it didn't tighten the requirements of what would happen if you didn't start implementing that. But it was a major commitment nonetheless. And what also has to follow from that is not just talks that are guided towards how do we now lock that in more firmly and actually transition off of fossil fuels, but also there has to be money behind it. So what they're talking about at this climate conference is putting up the finance, the capital, to help countries transition off of fossil fuels, to help countries leapfrog fossil fuels, but also to adapt to the climate crisis, low-income countries. So where the United States actually would come in even more importantly in some ways is to put up cash and to convince other countries to do the same, because that money is vital. And the Biden administration is certainly willing to put up a financial commitment. But what we can, be certain of is when Trump pulls us out of the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump surely will, there will be no money put up for climate finance. And that is devastating. Trump has repeated again and again and again in his speeches and in his last rambling victory speech, one of the policies he still hones in on, well, there's really two. It's deportations and fossil fuels. And he reiterated one of maybe three policies that he sought to mention in that victory speech was to drill baby drill, and that fossil fuels were going to be his mandate. And he has said that instead of where the U.S. currently has a climate czar, that he will instead have an energy czar, and that energy czar's goal or task will be uniting across all federal agencies the commitment to deregulation, reducing the rules by which we advance energy, and advancing fossil fuels. So that is diametrically opposed to the commitment that the U.S. government made to transition off of fossil fuels at the last COP. And it is diametrically opposed to what the United Nations has confirmed is necessary to protect public health, well-being, security, safety, and reduce the harms of the climate crisis. So that means that the United States will most likely significantly increase, has the potential to significantly increase our own contributions to the climate crisis in terms of the production and the burning of fossil fuels, but also to reduce the role that we play in helping other countries mitigate and transition off of fossil fuels. So that is, as you read in the beginning, Michael Mann's quote, potentially catastrophic. What's different now is we're 8 years further along in the warming of the planet. We're all experiencing, I think, in ways that we weren't 8 years ago, the impact of worsening extreme weather. And obviously, it is significantly harder on people and countries that have fewer resources with which to mitigate and adapt. Any community or country that was already underserved and marginalized prior to a climate crisis is significantly worse off following that climate crisis. And so, we so this is what the Trump administration is intending on doing. But just as they have spent, the members of that Trump administration have spent the last 4 years preparing for what they would do when they were back in power, or 8 years, 4 years, excuse me, so too has the environmental justice, environmental, climate justice, democracy movements around the country and around the world have also been preparing for what if there is another Trump administration. So those communities are also not being caught off guard. And we're hearing that from people at the Conference of Parties in Azerbaijan, that a lot of what's also happening there is sort of maybe trying to Trump-proof the United Nations climate process.
Hmm. Adam, what would you add?
Well, I mean, I think there's no other choice at this moment but for states and localities to take action on their own to the extent that they can. I mean, it's hard to overstate the significance of having a party in power in the world's largest superpower that still denies the reality of climate change. It's sort of hard to even fathom given the scale of the crisis. But I mean, the one thing I would say is that, and maybe this is something we'll get to later on in the show, is that much of what Trump tried to accomplish during his first term was unsuccessful, in part because the legal and advocacy community was able to challenge much of what they tried to do. Now, I don't think we're going to see the same kind of incompetence and chaos that characterized the first Trump presidency, but it is just to say that every move that they make will be challenged. It will take many months, years for them to roll back the Biden administration's regulatory program, which, you know, tried to sort of thread climate change concerns throughout sort of every agency. So, you know, it's not as if they're going to come in and flip a switch and everything's going to change. I mean, it will take time. There's process and procedure. And to the extent that they're successful will depend on, you know, whether they follow sort of the law. And I do think that preparing for sort of that reality is important. And also understanding that if folks organize and successfully sort of, you know, create a bulwark that can prevent some of the worst abuses of the Trump administration, that will help. And obviously, you know, in 4 years, there will be another election. So it's not sort of the end of climate, you know, the climate movement, of course, will continue. It has to.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because a lot of people are wondering how this is going to happen. So we know that he's going to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. He wants to dismantle the EPA, shrink the size of some national monuments to allow for more drilling and mining, gut environmental regulations and policies. There's so much. And the pause on permitting new liquefied natural gas exports to big markets in Asia and Europe. So how do you see this all playing out in the months to come?
Well, I mean, I think all of that will happen. They will make an effort to do every one of those things that you just described. But I think what I'm trying to convey is that you don't just come. I mean, I think in part what they tried to do the first time around is to through executive orders and other sort of mechanisms, you know, impose policy on these agencies, and in many cases it was unsuccessful. And you know, just looking at, you know, Alaska, for example, where the Trump administration, you know, tried to sort of implement this energy dominance agenda from day one, you know, many of their projects did not stand up to legal scrutiny. Now, I don't think we're going to see that same kind of sloppiness the second time around, but it's just, I think, a way of framing the sort of the battle that the climate movement will find itself in for the next 4 years. It is not it's not game over, it's not the end, it's sort of the next stage. And I think that folks need to be ready for that. And, you know, we know sort of their playbook. It's very clear. It's spelled out in Project 2025. We know who David Bernhardt is. We essentially know exactly what they're going to try to do. So I'm you know, and I know that the environmental community and the legal community is also that much farther ahead in terms of being prepared to kind of confront this administration.
Before we go to break, Antonia, is that how you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I both agree and disagree with Adam. I agree that it's not game over, and I agree that, you know, like, we know their playbook, and you know, the environmental community is ready to launch lawsuits and fight to protect the necessity to take action on the environment and public health and climate. But I would disagree that they were largely unsuccessful in the last administration. The Trump administration eliminated some 300 regulations, and that's lives lost, right? That's, you know, they gutted the Environmental Protection Agency. There was a lack of enforcement of the regulations that did exist, a cutting of regulations, an elimination of regulations, and a stalling of putting in place new regulations. So in the previous administration, Trump had committed to a 1-to-1 regulation. If we implement a new regulation, we have to gut two for everyone we put forward. Now he said it's going to be more than 10-to-1, maybe a 12-to-1. Hmm. And I take him at his word. And what we saw when the Biden-Harris administration came in was a lot of time lost having to try and put back regulations that were cut, trying to build back staff and money, and then time to deploy, to, you know, becoming more aggressive on enforcement on polluters, implementing really important rules like the methane rule and the chemicals rule, a new rule that implements tighter regulations on hundreds of harmful chemicals from fossil fuel and petrochemical operations. As you mentioned, the slowdown and potential ban on new LNG export facilities, and the trillions of dollars of investment, which I assume we can talk about after the break, in moving the economy away from fossil fuels and the transition to a green energy economy, including the $600 billion in environmental justice investment. You know, that it took time to build back. And while the Trump administration was in office, none of that was happening, which meant that there was more pollution, more harm, more death, and a reversal of when we needed to be moving forward on action on climate. And so I think, yes, it's very, very important to say, again, it's not game over. People know what to do. They're ready to do it. We're ready to roll up our sleeves. But the stakes are very, very high, and it's, you know, I think important to acknowledge the importance of the role of the federal government in regulating these sectors and the harm that can be done. It's not only a lack of regulation that's going to happen, it's a intentional move towards empowering polluters to pollute, I guess, for lack of a better way of wrapping up that sentence.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Antonia Yuhas, award-winning investigative journalist, and Adam Fetterman, award-winning investigative journalist and reporting fellow with Type Investigations. This is our One Planet series, and we are talking about what we can expect under a second Trump administration. What are your thoughts? How are you doing? How are you thinking about this? How do you want our One Planet series to cover the second Trump administration? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about why almost 75 million Americans voted for the most sexist and misogynistic campaign in U.S. history. And then on Wednesday, we're going to talk about why almost 75 million Americans voted for mass deportation. If you have a show idea, a guest idea, if you'd like to let us know how you think we should cover a second Trump term, what do you want from this show, given that we have an hour every day to talk about these crucial issues? We would love to hear from you. Your call at kalw.org. Today on our One Planet series, we're talking about what a second Trump term will mean for the climate crisis, the planet, and UN climate talks. We're joined by Antonia Yuhas, an award-winning investigative journalist focusing on energy, climate policy, and frontline communities. She serves on the National Press Club's COSIC Environmental Justice Grant Committee and developed the course Fossil Fuels and the Climate Crisis at Tulane University in New Orleans. She's the author of several books, including her most recent Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Adam Fetterman is an award-winning investigative journalist and a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. He writes about environmental policy, public lands, and corporations, and police spying on environmental activists. Adam, you have written extensively about how fossil fuel pollution and extraction affects frontline communities. We had you on when you wrote that piece about oil and gas projects in Alaska. According to the Washington Post, the Biden administration has moved to narrow the scope of an oil and gas lease sale in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that was mandated under Trump. So can you give us the latest? What is happening in the Arctic and what do you expect under Trump?
Yeah, right. I mean, one of the first moves actually through Congress, but obviously very much supported by the Trump administration, was this effort to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas leasing and exploration in 2017 through the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And it was part of his broader energy dominance agenda. And basically the law mandated that the Department of the Interior hold two lease sales in the wildlife refuge before the end of this year. So the first one was actually held on January 6, 2021, as the Capitol was being stormed. The Department of the Interior was holding the first ever lease sale in the refuge. And the Department of the Interior has just released the revised environmental impact statement for that oil and gas leasing program, and by law is required to hold a lease sale before the end of the year. And it's an interesting and I think instructive example of just how dramatically policy will change when Trump enters office, because the Biden administration redid the environmental analysis for this leasing program and arrived at a starkly different, you know, plan for continuing the program. I mean, they weren't able to ditch it altogether because it is mandated by Congress. But essentially, they're going to lease the smallest amount of acreage available. So I'm sure that, you know, as soon as Trump takes office and they appoint someone to oversee Alaska affairs, et cetera, they're going to reinstate the leases that were initially sold in the refuge and also potentially expand the program in the wildlife refuge and also expand oil and gas leasing in the National Petroleum Reserve to the west, which is also an area that the Biden administration has tried to protect 13 million acres of land and to prohibit leasing in a good chunk of that area. So we're going to see major policy changes on both fronts. And of course, this is in a place that's warming, you know, three times faster than anywhere else on the planet. So the impacts to communities on the North Slope and in Alaska will be profound. And those changes will be, you know, we will see those in real time, and the policy differences there are quite stark.
The Washington Post reports that last week, many environmental and indigenous advocates applauded the Biden administration for narrowing the upcoming lease sale in the refuge. They have successfully pressured major banks in the U.S. and Canada to stop financing oil projects, including Chase, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo. Are you in touch with your contacts, specifically Indigenous activists? What are you hearing from them about this, Adam?
Well, I am. I mean, I actually just wrapped up a story focusing mostly on the National Petroleum Reserve, which is to the west of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But, I mean, it's a complicated picture on the North Slope. You have a mix of both support for oil and gas development among Native corporations on the North Slope and also opposition from local communities and villages and tribes. It's certainly not a sort of a black and white picture, but... I mean, I think that there's a great deal of uncertainty regarding how these communities are going to adapt to climate chaos. I mean, you have villages in Alaska that literally are being relocated because of thawing permafrost and erosion and, you know, increasingly destructive coastal storms. And I think part of the conversation that we don't have when we shift to the focus on energy dominance is how do we adapt to the world that we currently live in? Mm-hmm. And I think this is where Antonia's work on frontline communities certainly comes into play, because that's really the other side of this story. And if we neglect that and we no longer invest in it or focus on it, even as journalists the impacts and the losses will be profound. And, you know, we see that on an almost daily basis in today's world.
Well, this is such an important point. And Antonia, you write about this. I mean, the United States is producing more crude oil than any other country. So what is going to be done with even more oil? Can you just, I mean, because he keeps saying, drill, baby, drill, we're going to produce more oil than you've ever seen. What are your thoughts about all of this, given what's happening right now?
Yeah, so under the Biden-Harris administration, the U.S. did reach new records of production in oil and gas. And I still believe quite firmly that that has to do more with policies that were put in place under the Trump administration that weren't able to be undone by Biden-Harris than a firm commitment from Biden-Harris administration to try to continue expanding production. Hmm. One of the things that happened, for example, I mentioned this last time I was on the show, was that one of the very first actions that President Biden took upon taking office was to ban any new fossil fuel leasing on public lands or waters. That was rescinded because it was attacked by Republicans' attorneys general who won in court that wasn't going to be permitted. And many different versions of trying to sort of get at production were successfully attacked. This administration, the Trump administration, is going to go the opposite direction. It's going to continue a trajectory which began during the first Trump administration, which is essentially loosening the regulations on when, where, how, and under what conditions production can take place, so that more land and waters are open to production and that it's open with fewer restrictions. At the same time, the Trump administration is going to try to extend the Trump-era tax credits. And those tax credits are also going to be expanded, Trump has said, to further reduce the corporate tax rate. So where it started when Trump came into office the first time was we had a 35% corporate tax rate. If Trump is successful, that will go down to 15% under his new administration. So that means more money available to these companies to do more work, for the fossil fuel industry to do more work in this case. And so I think we will see a further boom in U.S. production and in places that it isn't currently happening, including probably more aggressive offshore in more areas and potentially moving into sort of treasured public places like Bear's Ears or, the Grand Canyon, who knows. And then with fewer restrictions on it. So I think putting this back into this sort of international context is that Trump was also very clear when he was last in office that he was firming up his alliances with Russia and Saudi Arabia on many fronts, including being three states that would advance global fossil fuel interests and work together to do that. And I think that Trump has made clear his continued alliance, with Putin during his time off. I think we will see that alliance again. And sort of this question of whether the U.S. will become or is a petro state or a petro autocratic state, a petrotocracy, is an important question, because we certainly have the capacity. We produce, again, more oil and gas than any other country. The key difference, though, is one, we're not an autocratic government yet. And two, we don't have to be. So we're not reliant on fossil fuels. And I think that's really critical. Many other petro autocracies have that name because they are dependent on their fossil fuel production. We in no way, shape, or form need to be dependent whatsoever on fossil fuels. And I think one of the things that happened in this election is that Trump and the fossil fuel industry were able to successfully convince a large portion of the population that it was in their economic interest to maintain the reliance on fossil fuels. And I think that's unfortunate, because it's not true. It's significantly more costly, both to your individual home budget and to the nation as a whole, to remain dependent on fossil fuels. But also it ignored the immense benefits of the trillions of dollars of investment that the Biden-Harris administration were just getting off the ground. Sort of really quickly, through a set of laws, including the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law, trillions of dollars were made available to build out the green economy, to do it doing union jobs, and also with a focus, with 40% of that money, a commitment made that 40% of all of those funds would have to be targeted to environmental justice communities. So communities overburdened by pollution and underserved by government. These are disproportionately communities of color, but not only communities of color, it's also white low-income communities where there is a disproportionate preponderance of industries that create pollution and a lack of investment by government to support them in dealing with that pollution. And the benefits of that money were just starting to come through. We've already seen about 300,000 jobs nationally created through these funds, but also investments in localized, sustainable, renewable energy, in climate mitigation, in grid infrastructure, in supporting the investment in renewables, in supporting the ability of local frontline groups to do self-regulation, in essence, to have air monitors and to be able to measure the pollution of the industry that's happening around them and have resources to be able to act on that. That money is just starting to filter through. And what the Biden-Harris administration is trying to commit to is to basically spend as much of that money as they can before the end of this term, because the Trump administration, at least in Project 2025 and other proposals, have made clear their intent to try and eliminate the Inflation Reduction Act, potentially even the bilateral infrastructure law, and if not repeal them, significantly curtail the amount of funding that can be spent to eliminate the ability to fund community organizations directly or nonprofit organizations directly, and try and eliminate as much funding as possible for green energy. They really don't like green energy, and they also really don't like unions. And so an attempt to really just repeal as much of that as they can. And Trump has even said that he should have the ability to take back money that the federal government has put out. That is, I think will clearly be challenged in court should his administration try to do that. But they will definitely try to make a pretty frontal attack on these on the the renewable energy and environmental justice agenda and green energy agenda of the Biden-Harris administration, which will cost the United States and individual Americans a tremendous amount of money.
Is that certain? Is there anything that can be done to stop that?
People were going to try. I mean, you know, it's not easy to undo a piece of federal legislation. For one thing, a lot of Republican districts have benefited a lot from this money, and a lot of Republicans like this money. And so they're going to have a fight, and particularly if they have a slim majority in the House, that, you know, they'll be able to feel that there. They won't be able to lose any Republicans on anything they try and move through the House, basically, if they have the slim majority that is anticipated. And, you know, there's also going to be legal challenges. But a lot of the money, for example, through the bilateral infrastructure law, can't be distributed this year. It won't be able to be distributed until later years. So money that hasn't gone out, they will definitely have an easier time of challenging those expenditures. Money that has gone out the door, if they get all of this money out the door, if the Biden-Harris administration gets all the money out the door for the IRA, for example, the $600 billion for environmental justice communities, it will be very hard to pull it back, but that doesn't mean they won't try.
And Adam, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to talk about a piece you wrote for The Guardian in September with Jimmy Tobias. If Trump wins the election, U.S. parks and wildlife face a new age of mining. Trump would drastically weaken environmental protections and remake America's public lands. What do you expect?
Well, I would expect a wholesale assault on some of the bedrock environmental regulations that have been so crucial to kind of keeping these Western landscapes intact. I mean, one of the laws that we focused on in that piece was the Antiquities Act, which gives presidents the authority to create monuments. You know, Trump, during his first administration, they gutted Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. I would expect them to do the same, potentially try to shrink other monuments, but they also will gut, you know, the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. I would imagine will all be on the table, making it easier for the extractive industry to move into some of these once protected landscapes, including areas near, you know, the Grand Canyon, or as we just discussed, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that across the board, and it's, you know, the impacts will be real, and sort of the lasting damage, I think, will depend on whether, you know, the administration is able to get reelected in 4 years from now, because I think if they are not, then they will suffer the same fate in some ways as the Biden administration is now, in which all of their new rules and policies are going to be, you know, undone.
Adam, what do you think Trump's win means for environmental activists and protesters? Because you have also written about the war on protest. You did a lot of reporting on the crackdown on campuses over the horrific assault, the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza. You've also written about the U.S. government's decade-long campaign against the anti-pipeline movement. What do you think we can expect when people start standing up to all of this once again?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of uncertainty around this. I mean, certainly what Trump has said and what his allies have said is that he's willing to, you know, invoke the Insurrection Act and, you know, use the American military to put down protest. Now, whether that actually happens, we won't know until, you know, there is a response to policy that, you know, mobilizes people to protest what this administration is doing. I certainly think that anti-protest legislation at the state level and to some extent at the federal level has accelerated, particularly in the wake of you know, Israel's assault on Gaza. And, you know, one thing that I am watching is if, you know, Republicans control all three chambers, the, you know, the House and the Senate and the and the White House whether some of these new laws that have been proposed to crack down on campus protest and other protest movements will in fact move forward. So I think it's only going to become more difficult for protest movements to engage with this administration. And, you know, it's really an open question how that plays out.
Adam Fetterman is an award-winning investigative journalist and reporting fellow with Type Investigations. Antonia Juhas is an award-winning investigative journalist. Her latest book is called Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Antonia and Adam, thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Rose.
Thank you so much, Rose.
And also, I just wanted to mention that the Nature Conservancy has a piece called Big State and Local Wins for the Climate and Conservation in the United States. Just to give you a few examples of where the climate won on the ballot. In California, that $10 billion climate bond that will fund climate resilience, protect clean drinking water, and prevent catastrophic wildfires passed. In Washington State, an effort to roll back the state's Climate Commitment Act was defeated. In Minnesota, renewal of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund for another 25 years passed. The fund will provide $2 billion to protect water, land, and wildlife across the state. Voters approved a ballot measure in Suffolk County, New York, that will generate $6 billion for clean water and conservation over the next 30 years. In Colorado, they voted to remove the cap for water funding from an existing tax on sports gaming revenue. It's going to generate $2 to $5 million. The list is very long. And so this is where we're at. Because Trump is about to enter the White House, it's going to be up to states and local governments to pass these kinds of measures. And so we're definitely going to do many, many shows on this in the months and maybe years to come. Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.